very first day I took it out, I was like, oh my God, how good does this board go? I was just blown away how I could ride a 6.8, have all that paddle power, and then jump on the tail and still sort of turn it like a shortboard. Like, I just couldn't believe how fast it goes, how easy it is to paddle, and then how it turned. Oh my God, I just floated about 100 meters along the top of that thing and dropped down, and then Bod put the rail back in and went back into the next section. It went unreal. Went out, and my very first wave, I got like an excellent ride. It was like a high 8. And I just had this light bulb moment, like, you idiot. What have you been doing? Like, this is 2 liters more and it feels 10 times better. And I'm like, oh my God, if I'm doing this, the whole world's doing this. We're all riding boards too small.
Welcome to the Basis Surf Podcast. Super excited. We got Ian McPherson from Wooly TV. You probably know him for his board reviews. I love his board reviews because he has a awesome sense of humor, but he's also a surf coach, runs has a surf shop. Jack of all trades, man of many talents. Thanks for joining, Ian.
Thanks for having me, Van. I'm pretty stoked to be on the potty with you this morning. So, epic.
Awesome. Well, you know, the first question that I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we've been exchanging emails, and like at the bottom, I just see you and there's this massive wave behind you. So can you tell me the story about that wave, that picture?
Yeah, sure. That one's down the south coast of West Oz, so that's called the Right. Most people probably know about it. It's pretty famous these days for being one of the evilest waves around Australia, if not the world. I've only been down there a couple of times, and that particular time, it was only small, which was good for me because, yeah, it gets a lot bigger and uglier than that day. It was only sort of just breaking, and I just lucked in. I had a Phil Reed, Chopper Reed, he was towing me that day, and he's been down there a bunch of times. He's quite familiar with the place, and he managed to get me the biggest wave that came through that morning that we're out there. And yeah, that was that photo.
So it was, man.
Yeah, it was a good one, but it does look big, but compared to how big the Right gets, it's actually not a big wave in comparison to what guys are doing down there. It's quite small.
Right. Well, it, you know, it's all relative, but I can see the way that thing is drawing up, and that thing looks like it's pretty heavy. So like, what is going on in your brain as you're like, you know, cruising into this thing, as you're getting whipped into this? Is it just like not thinking about anything? You're just like, just complete instinct? Or are you like, you know, thinking about how shallow it is and all that?
Out there that day, I sort of had a couple of smaller ones, and it's a funny thing when you're tow surfing, even when it's on a bigger wave, a lot of the time you just don't fathom how big the waves are, and you'll kind of let go of the rope and fade or put yourself in position to drop into the wave. And that particular day, I had no idea. Honestly, it felt like it was like 4 or 5 feet and the biggest thing that I noticed on that one was when I was coming sort of out into the channel, the way that just draws so much water, it's hard to sort of stay positioned. It really wants to grab you and flip you into the lip. So that was one of the things. But yeah, you're not really thinking too much. You try and, yeah, don't panic and just try and use your instinct and all the things you've learned over years of towing and surfing bigger waves. It's kind of just sort of happens naturally. But yeah, it's funny. You pull up that night and look at the photos and the video and go, whoa, that was a little bigger than I thought it was.
That sounds heavy. That sounds super gnarly, but it sounds like quite a ride. Well, that's epic. So, you know, that's probably like peak surf experience, but let's bring it kind of back to the beginning. Like, I know you're from Western Australia. Tell us a little bit about kind of the beginning of all this, like how you got into surfing and a little bit about your background. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a place called Mandurah, which was quite a small town. When I was born, there was only 3,000 people there in the early 70s. So it was like a sort of a fishing village and a lot of retirees there, and there's a lot of holiday houses. It's being only sort of just an hour out of Perth, there was a lot of people from Perth that had holiday houses down there. But the good thing is it's got a lot of little reef breaks around the part of town where I grew up. And it doesn't get big. It's if you want to be a big wave surfer and grow up in Mandurah, you've got to travel 2 hours south down around Margs. But we were, yeah, I was really lucky. Mum was a swimmer. She's a competitive swimmer, and she used to drag myself and my brother, a couple of years younger than me, down to the beach regularly. And we were always called hyperactive, is what my mum and friends used to call myself and my next brother under me. And so she would spend time swimming and dragging us out in the water, body surfing, running up and down sand dunes, trying wear that energy out of her two eldest sons, and then somehow that happened to morph into a bit of surfing on a cooler on a foamy. So, mum, yeah, probably around 8 or 9, I think we started mucking around on foamies, and then got my first fiberglass board when I was about 10. Yeah, I got a nice little, I think it was like a 5'8" single fin. So I was lucky enough to start in the sort of early to mid 80s on single fins, and then onto a 20, and then onto secondhand thrusters. So yeah, it was a great part of the world. It's not that small down there anymore. It's kind of, around 80,000 people. So it was one of the fastest growing places in Australia for many, many years. But privileged, we were surrounded by water. We had a massive estuary. We learnt fishing and cray fishing, which is what you guys call rock lobsters. So they're called, yeah, they're called crays over here. But yeah, fishing, prawning, crabs. We've got a lot of crabs around there. Learnt how to dive from an early age, just free diving and sailing and all that fun stuff that you get to do when you grow up around a lot of water.
Man, that sounds like an epic childhood. And I'm sure that free diving experience comes in handy if you're towing into big waves, just comfort with holding your breath, huh?
In hindsight, I should have done a lot more of it. I kind of teetered around the edges of that. But yeah, a lot of my mates that are legit big wave guys, they're all free divers as well, for sure.
Right. And so did you, so you started surfing. Did you get obsessed early? And, how was, were you competing early, or what was that like?
Yeah, so my dad was a racehorse trainer. He used to break in horses. So we grew up on a property that was sort of walking distance to the beach. So I had both sides. I had the ocean, and then, dad had these aspirations for us boys, especially me being the eldest, to follow in his footsteps. So he used to have unbroken ponies and would throw us on those with, often without a saddle, and in the round yard, and start getting us to ride these things. And he did a really good job of scaring the absolute bejesus out of us. And, that was half the life. And then mum would drag us down the beach, and soon enough, surfing just took over. I sort of finished horse riding, by the time I was about 12, and not finished, but yeah, the passion just wasn't there for it, and surfing well and truly taken over. By the time I was 12 years old, I was in the local board riders club, and I think that's when I got my first brand new board from the local surf shop. And yeah, started competing, I think it would have been around 12, and then by 13 I was doing the junior state titles, and most of the first year high school I was doing all the comps that I could at the state level. Well, I've given up footy, which is AFL, our football over here. I'd given footy up, we'd given horse riding up all of the last year of primary school, year 7, around the age of 12. And then, just the salt water was absolutely flowing through the veins by first year high school. And that was all I dreamt of, thought of, wanted to be a pro surfer, posters on my wall, just live and breathe every day of wanting to be a surfer.
Oh man, yeah, that's epic. So first I'm like free diver. That's gonna contribute to being a good surfer. And then the next part is riding like crazy bucking broncos. I mean, like, I don't know. That seems like a match made in heaven in terms of like training to get into wave riding. So that's epic. So then as a surfer, were you always naturally a good surfer, or was it something that you had to work hard towards, or how would you describe that?
I wouldn't call myself a natural. I'm quite a determined human. And there was a lot of kids that were a lot better than me at that time. They'd sort of either started early or picked it up a lot faster. I definitely didn't just go straight to the top of of the state rounds or anything like that. I was sort of, we had a couple of kids around my age, and there's probably four of us that were sort of around the same level in the local board riders club, and I definitely wasn't at the top of that four. I was sort of in the middle, and then as I got to the state rounds, like, it took me a long time to make finals. I was kind of and if I did make a final, I was like fourth or fifth. Back then they'd still have five-man heats, and it was a totally different structure. You know, it was best four waves back then, and I'm not very good at focusing either. That's something that I had to learn over time. So I'd often make a lot of mistakes. I might have the best wave of the heat and then have absolutely no backups. I had no real mentors at that time, and there was no such thing as coaches back then. There really, no one got coached. That was not a thing at that time. I didn't make my first state team till I was 16 or 17. So all the kids that I was competing against and were friends of mine at the state level, they were all, you know, they'd all made 3, 4, 5 state teams by the time I had. So it was kind of, definitely didn't come easy, but I'm a persistent human, that's for sure.
Nice. Well, I think those stories are actually more interesting in a lot of ways, and there's kind of more value to be gained from them, like when you have to struggle through something versus if you're just naturally born with it. Do you remember any, like, hurdles that you hit that you overcame, and like how you overcame them, that might be useful for our community?
As from a competitive point of view, I think the biggest thing for me was just learning to calm your nerves. Like, as I got older and into sort of more of the open and the pro junior divisions, I would just constantly I'd lose my heat before I paddled out. I'd be, I know that guy, I've seen him in a magazine. You just got all this self-talk going on. And, I've seen that guy surf. Oh, my God, how am I ever going to beat him? And you've got this negative self-talk going on. So it was kind of, for me, I learned later about meditating and how to sort of control your breath. And I guess some of that would come through breath hold stuff as well once I got a bit older. But the very first thing that someone gave me, which worked for me, being a busy mind, that going back to that hyperactive description that was thrown around a lot before there was ADHD or ADD, that just wasn't a thing. It was, oh yeah, my boy's hyperactive. Well, I can tell you right now, I was undiagnosed ADHD. There's no doubt about it, and I can see it with my kids. I've got one of those ADHD. But I got a busy mind, or monkey mind. It's just too much going on. So if you're going to compete at a high level and you want to focus through a heat, this guy gave me, I don't know if they're the 3D books, you know, have you seen those books that you open up, you got to stare at it and the picture slowly comes out through the pixels of the art? Yeah. Have you seen those things?
Yeah, I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah, so someone told me about those, and I went and bought one, and I'd sneak off down the beach and pull that book out and just sit there and focus on that book, whether it be in the car or down the beach or somewhere else. And I distinctly remember doing it, going, oh, I can work these 3D pictures are coming out. This is amazing. And then I went out and surfed a really good heat. Like, it put me, emptied my mind and cleaned me out and sent me out there where I could sort of start making a few better decisions while I was competing. So that was a real turning point for me. And it wasn't till much years later, like, I was a late bloomer. I literally don't reckon I started surfing my best heats until I was in my late 20s. And by then, you know, I was way past the opportunity to become a pro surfer. But that one thing, that simple thing of just emptying your mind and focusing on the tasks in front of you, that book was the start of it. And then much, much later, it was, you know, all about breathing and counting your breaths and a little bit of basic meditation to help me prep before I paddled out. And I use it not just competing, but I actually do use that free surfing. Sometimes I'm having a bad surf and I'll sit out the back and just push the reset button, and I'll breathe and, you know, count my breaths and just get my head together. And then hopefully the next wave I'm back in form. So I don't know. There's a lot to be said about people with the busy minds and just focusing and taking all that pressure off yourself and just paddling out in a really good state, mental state.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's obviously the context for that was in competition, but I think it applies to your everyday surfer as well. You know, sometimes you go out, you see that it's busy, you see there's lots of like really good surfers, you might be intimidated, and you know, kind of what you talked about seems like a good way to clear your mind and get into the right mindset before you go for your surf. So, no, that makes a lot of sense. So that's on the mental side. What about on the technique side? Was there anything that you struggled with, or I don't know, I know you're a surf coach. What are the kind of common things that you see with some of your clients that people struggle with that, you know, that you've been able to help unlock or you were able to unlock for yourself?
So firstly, for me, we'll talk about the hurdles. I'm quite tall. I'm almost 6'2", and I was always quite a skinny kid. I was all arms and legs, so my style was erratic and pretty poor. I did a lot of I was lucky. My dad, back to the horses, he bought a video camera for filming horses at the track when he was training, because before races at the trials. So my brother and I used to steal his camera and started doing video footage pretty early, which at the time, you know, they were the big VHS cassette in the side of it. It was in the 80s. And so we could literally film on that camera and then bring it home and put it in the VCR. So it was like, it wasn't a handy camera or anything like that. It was a massive big camera. It was pretty hard to steal off the old man when and not get caught. But we would grab it and take that down and started doing some. Before, we didn't know what we were doing. We just thought we were just filming ourselves. But essentially, we're doing video analysis stuff really early. So I soon learned that my style was horrendous, and I was a big gangly praying mantis. And one of the things I had to work on was trying to keep my arms from throwing around everywhere. So that was one of the hurdles and one of the things I worked through, and I'm still working through that today as a bigger guy, and trying to just improve with the board. The amount of filming I do with the board reviews, it's kind of good. I get to do a lot of video analysis stuff and be super critical of myself and my style, and just keep trying to improve that technique as I get older. So that's that stuff. As far as unlocking things for other people go, depends on what level they're at. I find that paddling for beginners and intermediate, just paddling and positioning on the board is such a big thing, and getting that initial speed and the paddling correct so that when you stand up, you're already at wave speed or beyond wave speed. And I just, it's amazing how much better someone can get really fast if they've got a really paddling technique. And that then sets you up for the initial speed and, you know, roll straight into compressing and extending and learning to generate speed, because it all comes from the paddle, and then it goes from the paddle into creating speed. And once you've taught someone how to go fast, then it just unlocks a whole range of maneuvers that they can work on. But if someone can't paddle correctly and can't generate speed, then that just holds them back from being able to learn anything else after that, any critical turns or any big open face turns or just anything. It all comes from that initial speed. And I found when I first started coaching sort of more intermediate and advanced surfers, I was having to look back at myself and go, well, how come, hang on, how come I can create speed? And I worked backwards from there, going, all right, well, I know how I do it now. How do I educate and help others, you know, nurture others into being able to do the same thing, which is something I've been doing a lot of the last few years with the video analysis stuff. It's really good to help that intermediate advanced surfer.
Hey everyone, it's Van. Hopefully you've been enjoying the podcast. Hopefully you've been listening to some good stories, getting some good tips that are helping you improve as a surfer. If so, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review. It'll only take you literally a few seconds, and share it with your friends. That's the best way you can support me so I can continue to create awesome new content for you. So thanks. Yeah. Well, on the paddling side, what is it that you see that people are, what mistakes are they making? Is it just not paddling hard enough? I mean, that's often the biggest issue, I mean, that I've seen, but.
Yeah, but it's more so the technique. I see people, some people paddle really wide. They have their hands out wide from the board. They're not sort of pointing up towards the nose and doing a nice sort of, you know, semi freestyle stroke. I see others that go really hard, but all they're doing is splashing like windmills. So you see. It's more, I'd rather see a slower technique that's correct than someone making a lot of water splash around and not actually propel themselves forward. So The other one too is the way their position, where their chest and chin are over the board. A lot of crew have got their back arched way too high. So it's about finding that balance and the position on the board so that your body's in a good spot where you can adjust just by arching your back a little, whether you need to go down or up. And then also just, just a nice, long, strong stroke so that they're powering into the wave before they actually jump up to their feet.
Yeah, totally. On that point about paddling hard and people splashing, I mean, I think so much of surfing is just developing a feel for the water, whether it be with your hands in just terms of like catching the water, but also with your feet in terms of developing sensitivity on your rails to engage your board for your turns. And so, yeah, what you're talking about makes so much sense. And it's something that I was thinking about today as I was surfing. I was like, you know, there's this big wave coming and I'm paddling for it. And I was like, all right, I'm just really trying to grab and feel the water, you know? So you're definitely, when you say paddle hard, when I say paddle hard, it's definitely not just like splashing the water. It's what you're talking about there. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Just getting that technique right. And then it's the, you know, some people don't do it at all. And some people do a lot of it, but kicking as well. There is a time and a place for kicking, you know. I find myself just the last couple of strokes into a wave, often I'll give a couple of big kicks. But, you know, that just depends on what board you're riding, you know, where your feet are positioned. Obviously, that doesn't work on mid-lengths and long boards, but on shorter boards, just a couple of little kicks can often really help right at the end, just before you stand up.
Yeah, for sure. And are you of the opinion, because you know, this is a debate that I see in my comment section sometimes. What's your opinion on head down or head up when you're paddling for a wave? I think I know what your answer is, but just to clarify, because you talked about adjusting your head, but, you know, when you're paddling in hard, those last few strokes to get into a wave, head up or head down, what's your opinion?
As in eyes or, like, just in the arch of your back? I'm not...
Yeah, like, do you want to have a big arch with your head up as you're paddling into the wave, or do you want to have your head down?
For me, I think head down until the last moment. It's kind of head down for that last critical stroke. So then as soon as you're starting to drift into the wave or cruise into the wave, then it goes to sort of head up as part of, it's almost part of your pop, you know, you're getting to your feet, which pop up I don't really like to use, but yeah, it's part of your pop right. up, your head comes back up.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, because you need to get that weight forward to slide into that wave, right?
And yeah, I feel correct. Like, and if you've got your back arch, then your weight's moving further back, which can help if you're about to nosedive or you're taking off on an extremely steep wave. But I'm a head down guy and paddle those last few strokes really hard so that you're in the best position you can get in before you get to your feet.
Yeah. And so, you know, as a coach, but then also reviewing boards, like what kind of recommendations do you typically give to, you know, some of your clients? Like, you know, you review mid lengths, you got grovelers, you got big, wide, stubby things, you got your high performance short boards. How should, you know, when you're talking to a client, like how should they think about it?
It really depends on what type of waves they're riding. You know, I always try and find out what are the most common waves you're going to surf. There's no point going, oh yeah, I really like, you know, overhead surf. And I'm like, okay, well, that's great. How often do you get to surf that? Oh, you know, when I'm away on a trip. Okay, all right, great. So we're not buying a board for when you're away on a trip, unless it's a part of your quiver. One of the biggest things I find is that crew read too much into go on a website and go, okay, we'll just use Parco for instance. Oh, Parco's, you know, 80 whatever kilos and he's 6 foot and I'm 80 kilos and I'm 6 foot. So I'm going to get that board that Parco rides. You know, that's one of the biggest things that I find is a problem because we can't ride those boards. You know, I can't ride, if I pick a pros board that's my height and weight, I can't ride it. It's not for me. And I think we've just got to start from scratch when we're talking to people and really dig deep into what waves they're riding, what their skill levels are, and then try and figure out what shape's going to work best for them on those conditions. But most guys already have a picture in their head what they want. And it's about trying to unlock what the, if I haven't coached them, if it's just a customer in the store or I'm just helping someone online, it's trying to figure out what their surfing ability is, because, you know, you've got all those stages of the growth of your surfing, from beginner to intermediate and onwards up from there. And you've got to try and figure out where they're at. Otherwise, you put them on a board too small, too big, under volume, over volume. I think one of the biggest things, I reckon 90%+ of the people that surf ride boards that are under volume for their age, weight, and fitness and ability. I just think everyone rides boards too small.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that I noticed with your reviews is you're a very high level surfer and you'll still bump up the volume, you know, and you'll talk about, I remember it was some review and you're like, oh, I wish I'd actually gotten this board an extra size up even, you know, after having tried it. So if someone as good as you still wants more volume in their boards and is already generously volume, you know, adding volume to their boards, then, you know, it says, you know, well, for a lot of surfers, they probably benefit from doing the same, right?
Yeah, well, firstly, thanks, high-level surfer. I appreciate that, Van. I feel like I'm an aging intermediate to advanced surfer these days. But look, I always had in my mind, which a lot of people do, I've got to ride this, I've got to ride that. I was riding, at 40 years old, I was riding boards at 29 litres and I was around 87 to 90 kilos, which is almost 200 pounds. So yeah, I'm just under 200 pounds most of the time. So to be riding a board that's 29 litres, and at the time I had this calculation in my head that I just had to ride a third of my weight. And I was like looking at what the pros are riding and just going, yep, that's what I'm going to ride. And that was fine when I was 40. And then I was competing and I actually buckled my favorite board and I went into the shop, went to my store, and I had to have a heat that afternoon. So I just went, and the closest one I could find was 31 litres, same length I think it might have been an inch longer of the same model, but I just grabbed it off the shelf and went out, and my very first wave, I got like an excellent ride. It was like a high 8. And I just had this light bulb moment, like, you idiot. What have you been doing? Like, this is 2 liters more and it feels 10 times better. So that was my first light bulb moment. And I'm like, oh my God, if I'm doing this, the whole world's doing this. We're all riding boards too small. And and then that got reinforced because I had 2 quivers after the Margaret River Pro turn up in the shop. Now, one was Geordie's and one was, and then there's a bunch of boards for Mikey Wright. And I picked up Geordie's boards, this is around the same time, picked up Geordie's boards and went, oh my God, this guy's riding boards bigger volume and thicker rail than I'm riding. He's, at the time, he was top 5 in the world, under 30, super fit. You know, what have I been doing, you idiot? You know, it's like, and I was such a stock standard guy, you know, like a white bread, you know, performance short board. I'd never rode anything else. Occasionally I had, a mate of mine's a really good shaper over in the East Coast called Chris Garrett. He does a lot of, you know, alternate crafts, and he was making me fishes in the 90s and things like that when there was just none around, you know, around the time that Curran was riding that stuff out at Big Bower. And I had a fish back then. Anyway, I wrote a bunch of different craft from him, but generally speaking, I'm a standard performance, you know, high performance shortboard type of guy all day, every day. And I'd always, I was just stuck in this rut of what I had to ride. And then within a few months, I was up to like 33 litres. So I've gone from 29 litre boards to 33 litre boards. And volume's not everything, but that's a big increase in volume over a very short period of time. And I was just like, oh my God, not only, the funny thing is when you're under volume, you're paddling in, you're always late, you can create speed, but it's hard work. When you put a bit more foam under your chest, you're paddling, you're entering the waves early. Then when you stand up, you're going faster. Then you go to do your first sort of pump and swoop, you're going even faster again. Then when you do your turn, you've got so much speed, the extra volume's just gone. You don't even notice it. You can just throw the board, you know, so easy because you created speed. The board's helped you create the speed. Then you can push it around just like you can ride in 6 to 8 foot surf. You can ride a 6 foot 8 or a 7 foot board and throw it around like a shortboard, because it's all just relative to the power and the wave and how fast you're going. So that was a bit of a light bulb moment for me with those crafts. And I think that the biggest take out of that is, if I was doing that, then, you know, in my mind, I reckon it's about 90% of the people are riding boards under volumed and too small for them.
Oh yeah. Especially if you're, you know, competing and all that. And that's crazy. And you know what's interesting as well? I've noticed, so you were looking at the discrepancy between your volume and Jordy back then, but I feel like more recently, a lot of pros have been talking about bumping up their volume like now. Like, I think Kanoa Igarashi was talking about one of the adjustments for this season is like he's riding higher volume in his boards. And Kelly was talking about how he's riding more volume. Like, all these guys are bumping up the volume. And so I think it's really interesting. And Kelly was talking about how he's bumped up the volume and he hasn't felt a big difference in terms of, you know, loss of control or whatnot. So that's been really interesting that even the high level pros are coming around to that.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. And I think the modern shapes and the shapers are so good at hiding foam these days. They can still have absolutely beautiful performance boards just with this extra foam in there. You know, there's a lot of the guys like JS do the Easy Riders, you know, Pizel, the XLs, the Lost to do an XL version as well. So they're actually catering for guys that can surf that are just either bigger, taller, or carrying a bit of weight. So it's a pretty exciting time for, you know, back in the day, everything was just 6'3", 6'4", 8 1/4, 2 1/4, you know, 8 3/8, 2 3/8. It was just straight up and down for such a long time. And there was no performance boards for bigger guys. It just wasn't a thing. Everything was built for someone that was, you know, like 75 kilos.
So, yeah. So
I don't know, 160, 170 pounds sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. So what are your recommendations for bigger framed people? Like, are there, you know, how should they tweak their boards? Like, should they make sure to get, because there must be some kind of relationship, right? That, you know, a lot of board builders, they do like the XL versions where it's like thicker rails, but then similar width. Is that kind of what you should go for? Or what are the considerations that people should think about?
Again, back to what waves are you riding most? Work the board model or there's nothing wrong with working with your local shaper too. You know, it's like go get a custom board and work closely with your local shaper. That's great. I did that forever. But I just think you can't go too wide. If you want a performance board, you can't go too wide. So depending on how heavy you are, you probably don't really want to go out beyond sort of, you know, 9 3/4, 20 inches wide, depending again on what type of waves. In the flatter waves, absolutely you can go wider than that. But for a performance short board, I think for someone around that 200 pounds, I think, you know, probably no wider, you know, in say a 6.0, 6.1, probably no wider than around 20 inches. And then you can tuck the foam up around the stringer and have the rails pulled down. So you can, you know, some boards of mine are up around 2 3/4, but most of them sit around 2 5/8. So I think around that sort of, you know, if you're working around 20 inches, 19 7/8, and around, 2 5/8, 2 3/4 with a bit of a rolled deck with pinched rails, you can still get an absolute performance shortboard out of those dims and be able to surf perfect, you know, overhead surf and still surf them like a grommet. There's no doubt about it.
That's awesome. So that's kind of your view on performance boards, but let's get into some of these more alternative boards. I think the you know, there was a board review of yours that made me go out and buy a board. I saw your review of the JS Big Baron, and I live in the Northeast. Yeah. I live in the Northeast, and, you know, it's either like 2 foot mush. I mean, we get rippable waves every once in a while. I mean, we definitely do have our days, but it's like 2 foot mush, or it's like overhead pumping and barreling, you know? And it's this weird thing where it's kind of like mushy takeoff, but then like it hits the bar and then it gets really hollow. And, you know, there's a lot of good surfers that ride bigger boards as well, just to, cause we got crazy current, you know, it's sandbars and, you know, all that. So, when I saw you going nuts on that 6.8, I was like, what is going on? Like, tell us about your experience with the Big Baron, or is that still your favorite mid-length? What's your favorite mid-length nowadays? I know you've tested a bunch.
I don't ride mids all that often. It's funny. I just end up because I'm reviewing so many boards, I'm almost on a different board every surf these days, and then I just have my stock quiver. But is the Big Baron still in my possession? Absolutely. Yeah, that board. So there was two boards that year that surprised me that I never ever would have pulled off the shelf to ride, and I only rode them because I was reviewing them. And the Big Baron was one, and the other one was the Slater Designs Flat Earth. But we can talk about that in a minute. The Big Baron, I was just blown away how I could ride a 6.8, have all that paddle power, and then jump on the tail and still sort of turn it like a shortboard. Like, I just couldn't believe how fast it goes, how easy it is to paddle, and then how it turns. You know, like I remember the review really well because I kept coming in going, did you get that one? Did you see that? Oh my God. I just floated about 100 meters along the top of that thing and dropped down, and then Bod put the rail back in and went back into the next section. Like, I was coming in from the surfs going, I cannot believe I just did that on that board. Like, it was, it just opened up. And, you know, big mushy kind of onshore surf, all of a sudden, you know, I might have looked at it going, oh, I can't be bothered dealing with that. Whereas with the Big Baron, it was just jump on it and you've got all that paddle power. You can still duck dive. It was only 38.5 liters, that one of mine, 6.8. So it had really like super pinched pulled rails, and the longer straighter outline just allows you to sort of engage the rail at the bottom and just overtake massive sections. It was kind of, and I found it also, you know, back on technique, it really smoothed out my style and kind of made me approach the waves a little bit differently. So that was kind of a really good experience too. It was an epic board. Love that thing.
Yeah, it was nuts. I saw you float like a football field. That was the craziest wave. The I saw that and I was like, yeah. I saw that. I was like, that would come in handy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you like your one? You're enjoying yours?
Oh my God. It's nuts. It's nuts. I mean, I've ridden it like in 1 to 2 foot waves. I've ridden it on the North Shore of Hawaii when most of the spots are closed out and like, you know, pretty big waves. You know, I was scared for my life out there, but you know, most people were wearing impact vests and had helmets and guns, and I was on the 6.8. I mean, it was stupid. My buddy was like on a 9.6, and I'm like, what am I doing on this thing? But like, it paddled into waves like my buddy's 9.6 almost, even though it's like 3 feet shorter, but it's just like that width. And then the rail, that the foil on that board is so weird. Like, you sit on the board and you think because it's so wide that it's going to be like this boat, but it's so thin. It's actually like almost unstable because that foil is just so thin. And so that rail just knifes into the side of into the wave. I've gotten barreled on the thing. Like, I snapped the board in a barrel. It's the craziest board I've ever ridden. And I'm really bummed that I snapped it actually. Thank you for doing that review because that opened my eyes up to things for sure.
Yeah, well, the JS guys would constantly ring me going, I cannot believe how many inquiries we've had after you did that review for us. It was like they were constantly going, we just had another guy on the phone talking about your review. And then same thing through the retail spaces on the East Coast. I got a lot of mates that own shops on the East Coast of Australia. And that was definitely one of the first reviews I did that sort of blew up and had a lot of crew talking about that particular board. There's no doubt about it. That was an absolute smoker.
Wow. Well, what is the, I know that there's that JS Baron Flyer Twin. I didn't get to watch the review, but it kind of looks like a small Big Baron. I mean, is that what it's like, or how should you think about that one?
So the issue, it's not an issue, but the thing that annoys me about sort of shorter twins is the ones with the big wide tails on them. Like, cause I'm not Rasta. I'm not Asher Pacey. I'm not one of those guys that can just ride anything and make it look graceful. Like, I have to work hard on riding twinnies, especially cause I'm so tall and have so much leverage because of my height. The smaller ones with the wide, you know, big wide fish tails, big swallows on them, I do have a bit of trouble riding those, and often I have to put the biggest fins they make in futures in there to get them to hold for me. So The thing that I like about the Baron Flyer is it's kind of got like this flyer into a round tail, and it's just got so much more hold than like the bigger, wider swallows, like the original ones, like the Red Baron and the Black Baron. And it's so fast, like it's really flat, really fast. It does feel, and the rails, it does feel like a shorter performance version of the Big Baron. But obviously, 510, I think that one was, I was riding compared to a 6.8. You're drawing much tighter, different lines on it, but it has got a similar feel, but it's a little bit more high performance, and you can just get it to transition rail to rail a lot faster than obviously a 6.8 does. But
That
yeah,
sounds
you'll have to
interesting.
watch that one. That one was a lot of fun. Had some really fun waves on that board. It was good.
Yeah, that looks like a really interesting board to ride as well. Well, you said that the Flat Earth was the other board that kind of surprised you and blew your mind. What's the story there?
Yeah, so in that year, that was a few years ago now, I did the Baron, the Big Baron, and the Flat Earth. So those two boards, if I wasn't doing board reviews, there is absolutely no way in hell that I would have pulled them off the shelf and reviewed them. The Baron, obviously, I'm not a longboard guy. I'm pretty hopeless at riding longboards. I'm trying to open my mind and do whatever I can. I'm riding a lot of more mids these days and enjoying it. They've been really good, but I wouldn't have pulled that off to surf it. I wouldn't have pulled the Flat Earth off. There's no way. Like the Flat Earth, for me, is just something that it's just not appealing to me off the shelf when I'm so used to riding white bread performance boards, just stock standard high performance shorties. And the thing about that Flat Earth, it had the same, it's got a funny flyer into a sort of a rounded, it's almost like a thumbtail. It's a cross between a, it's not really rounded square, it's not a squash, and it's definitely not an area pin, but somewhere in the middle, it's quite a funny outline. It's got really pinched rails. It's got like a quite thick in the middle. And at the time, I was mainly riding sort of boards around 6.0. Around 33, 33.5 liters was kind of my stock standard go-to at the time, and that one, the demo that I could get to review was 36 liters, and I remember going, "Oh, we'll just see how it goes." I've just got it, I'd started to ride a few different boards at the time, but and it had a really clustered fin setup because it's a 2+1. So when you look at the fins, like you've got the twins in here, and the back fin is like almost there, like the tabs for it. It's definitely not a thruster. No, not even close to a thruster fin placement. So I chucked in a set of that had FCS in it, that board, and I put MR 2+1s in it. And the very first day I took it out, I was like, "Oh my God, how good does this board go?" It was just free. It had the feel of a 20. Yet with the little trailer with the trainer wheels in the back, you could really push it like a thruster. Like it just didn't do anything weird off the bottom ever. It just held so well. It carried speed. I worked out that for me, it worked really well in waves that had like a steep section, then a flat section, then a steep section. And like if you had to connect the dots across a wave, it went unreal. That was probably the best conditions that I found that it worked in. And I just remember, going, I never would have ridden that board had I've not been reviewing it. It really, those two in particular was a point when I through the reviews and through that process that I just went, I got to, I just got to, I can't judge a board off the shelf now. This is it. I've just ridden two boards this year that are completely different to what I ride. I've just got to grab them, make sure there's enough foam in it for me, and just go into the reviews with an open mind. So thanks to those two boards, I guess it sort of got me off the thought process of my boards had to be like that, just opened up my mind as to what went well.
That's so interesting. But I'm assuming that you still ride your normal your thrusters, but you like to mix it up now.
Honestly, I like most of the time I'm riding
Right.
off. Often I'll ride review boards.
Right,
I'm
right, right.
trying to punch out. I was really my goal is to do sort of 24 in a year, which is one every 2 weeks, and I'm sort of finding that almost impossible, especially since we've had a really really flat summer. So the stuff that I'm putting out now sort of started back in October, November. And we just haven't been able to finish it. So yeah, the goal of trying to get 24 out in a year, like my goal was always 12, and I've achieved that last year. We got out, I think, 13. So that was out, and I really wanted to ramp it up this year. We're having troubles trying to get through them all. But what that does is means that when I am surfing, if there's a film around, I'm on a different board almost every day, and I'll often take three boards. I'll be reviewing three boards at once, and I'll take three with me down to the beach, and I'll do an hour on each one. I'm having to jump from twinnies to performance boards to, you know, other alternative craft, and I'm having to just get in the zone and try and, often there's one day, which is in a lot of the films, this one day on a right-hander, it's really nice right-hander that's perfect for board testing, and the HS Holy Hypto's out there, the CI2 Pro that I'm about to release is out there on the same day, the Baron Fly is out there. What else was there? I literally rode five boards in 5 hours on this right-hander. So that right's turning up in that particular surf's going to turn up in five different reviews. But what it does is, it's really hard to jump from a 20 to a performance board and back to a different construction performance board or a step down and then onto the next thing. It's got its challenges. But back to your question, yes, I do have a whole quiver of performance, from one shaper, from the JS guys. I've got a whole quiver. If I'm going on a surf trip, I might take one or two boards I'm reviewing and then take five or so of my normal, performance boards from 6.0 to, up to guns as well, semi-guns and guns. So do have boards that I step back onto and they just feel like my long-lost brother when I stand on them. And I just know that those ones are going to work in all those conditions for me. But I often won't ride them for months because I'm doing board reviews every surf.
Man, that must be so trippy to go like five different boards in the same session. Like in the boards that you described, like going from like the CI2 Pro to like what sound like small, or the Hypto or whatever, like, regular, more like alternative kind of everyday boards. That sounds like must throw your head for a loop. Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think it's actually good for your surfing. I think once you figure it out, and especially when I grab a new one and I haven't caught a wave on it, often I'll just, and I had this conversation with one of the guys I coached this week, often I'll just start, like paddle in, take off, and just get to the end of the wave. Just go down the line, generating speed, getting my feet in the wax, and just do one turn at the end. Some waves are too good and you can't do that. You'll just want to rip thing a new one. But it's if I'm having trouble or I'm changing through a variety of boards, I'll try and just sort of clean the palette and just go down the line, get my feet in the wax and do one turn on the end of the wave. I think that helps a lot doing that.
And do you think for, your everyday surfer, it's a good thing to switch boards a lot and experiment a lot? Or do you think they should kind of like stick to one board? Or what's your philosophy on it? I mean, and obviously you're going to have a quiver, different conditions. But let's say, you're like head high wave. Like, okay, what board are you going to be? Would you recommend constantly switching it up or just dialing it in on one board?
I think for intermediate surfers, you're better off trying to keep sticking to the one board and make it work. I reckon as you get more into that, advanced level, I think you can jump from board to board a little easier. I think, in say, like you said, head high surf, I reckon just pick your board that's designed for that and just ride that. I'm not sure jumping from board to board is a good thing when you're at that sort of curve of your surfing. I think you should just keep working on the one and then update that as you improve or get fitter or paddling's better or whatever you're trying to achieve out of your surfing. But it can really mess with people if you're like what I'm doing. I wouldn't wish that upon anyone. It's kind of it's challenging, you can do your head in. You've got to have a pretty good mindset and be able to just jump from board to board. It's not something that I think is easy. It's not easy to do.
Right. It sounds hard. I mean, I'm on a surf trip right now and I have my two short boards. And then I also have this, ASIM twin and I really want to experiment on it, but it feels so different that like I played around with it, but like I'm like, I got to stick to my normal boards cause I'm just trying to dial it in. So, cause jumping back and forth is kind of throwing my head for a loop as well.
And you're on a surf trip too. Every wave counts. Every wave counts when you're on a surf trip.
I gotta soak it in.
Yeah, that's it.
Exactly. So you also mentioned that, you know, it's summertime, so you're riding a lot of small, your waves are small right now. So what's your favorite board for really small waves?
I've just done the review recently on that, the Firewire Sweet Potato, the Damn Man one. That was a massive surprise for me. Like that, I had so much fun riding that board. And again, you know, 5 years ago, I would have looked at that and said, yep, that's an old man's board. I won't be touching that. That can stay on the shelf. As soon as I got on it, I'm like, wow, I was literally surfing knee-high surf and doing turns on it. So I've never had a board that's 5, 6 and 38 litres or whatever it is. It's around about that high 30s. I've never even ridden a board like that design and shape, and I had a lot of fun on that. And usually before that, I would ride often I'd ride the JS Sub-Zero. That was kind of a go-to, or the model before that was called the Psycho Nitro. So I'd often go to those boards when it's really small. But I just got a Flame Fish. Last week I was over at doing some work on the Gold Coast with the JS guys, and they gave me one of the Flame Fishes, which is, I think, 5'8", around 36.5 litres from memory. So it's quite wide, really wide nose, really flat, really thick up the front. So I haven't ridden that yet. That's going to be, I'm going to have a play on that. But that looks like a lot of fun. It kind of looks like a different version of the Sweet Potato that sort of should excel in sort of knee-to-waist high waves. They reckon they sell a heap of them in California for California summer.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, we've been talking a lot about like what your favorite boards are, but I also know that you own a surf shop. And I'm curious, like, what boards are actually the most popular? Like, You know, what does the public actually buy a lot of?
So in Australia, like I'm in West Oz, so we're a little bit different to the rest of the country. But my number one selling board was and will continue to be for a while, is the JS Zero Gravity, which is just like a sort of 1-inch step down from a performance board. It's just a great sort of daily driver, I guess, is what a lot of people call those sort of boards these days. So that one is my number one seller through the retail space. The other ones that have done the past 3 years, the Big Baron was actually massive. Like that board over those couple of years was enormous, and kind of almost embarrassing to say that a mid-length was, you know, after all the boards of 550 boards we've got in the shop, the best seller in volume was actually a Big Baron for about 12 months. That opened up, you know, I guess a lot of people, it just covers off a massive part of the market, you know. It was a really good mid-length, and it was for crew, you could get a bigger high volume one, for crew that intermediate and learning, then good surfers could get the lower volume one and use it to rip on it. Older guys that struggling to paddle but didn't want to go to a longboard, that was ticking that box. So that one was huge for me. The Flat Earth did really, really well out of the Firewire stable. That one went nuts. And then the Seaside, the Firewire Seaside is still selling really, really well, even though it's about 5 or 6 years old. And the other one we do a lot of business in is the Oki board, the JS Raging Bull. Again, it's got a lot of volume in it, but it's still a performance board. So you'll find, and the other one, that's the Zero Gravity, that one in the Easy Rider Dims does really well for me too. So they just, all those sort of models, if we talk the Flat Earth, the Seaside, they're both, you know, Flat Earth's quite a high volume for its length. The Seaside's obviously massive volume for its length. The Mid, the Baron is, you know, a variety of volumes in there for the length. The Oki board is a high volume board, but it's a performance board. And then Zero Gravity, again, daily driver, and that comes in those Easy Rider Dims as well. So to sell a lot of boards, you've got to cater to a big part of the market, and I think all those models sort of do that with the volumes and options that are available there.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think that's kind of what I would expect, right? I would kind of imagine that your still the most popular board would be your, you know, kind of like a step down everyday short board. But then increasingly, I would imagine there's more of these alternative boards like the mid-length, Big Baron, and all that. And you guys are in Australia, so in Western Australia, you guys have really good waves. So it makes sense that it's going to be a lot of like those performance boards, like, you know, the Aki board looks really sick. And who doesn't want to surf like Aki, right? So it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Cool. Well, we got to work towards wrapping up. Any last final tips for the audience? Any kind of last things you want to say as well?
If you're for improving as you get older, like I turn 50 next month, so other than trying to figure out ways to get the grays out of your beard and have to go to a mow and shave your face a bit more often, that always helps make you look a little bit younger. But as far as surfing goes, I come off a massive injury, not last year, the year before. I did two knee injuries. One was a 100% rupture of an MCL. So I was out of the water for 8 months with that injury. And when I came back from there, I was really stiff through my hips, my lower back. I suffered from sort of a lot of knee injuries and also lower back issues and tight hips from, I do about 1,000 Ks of driving a week, and I sit in the desk too often doing book work and whatnot in the computer. So I actually was dragging my front foot. My first few surfs, I was bending my toe next to my big toe back under my foot every time, and it was so sore and swollen, it was going black. So I had to strap those two toes together, and I was like, I can't do this. This is actually so painful. And I reckon I fractured one of them at one point during this getting back into surfing. And then I was like, I've got to fix this. What the hell is it? Why am I dragging my front foot? And I remember people, older crew, talking about it and saying they drag their toes. I'm like, drag your toes? How the hell do you just drag your toes? I don't even get that. You just jump up. But sure enough, after being in a brace in my knee for 8 months, and I was doing all the rehab and working with a strength and conditioning coach and physio and getting all that done, but there was something missing. Like, I literally could not pop up like I used to. I was just dragging my front foot, and I couldn't work out why. So I went and sort of showed the physio, I showed the strength and conditioning coach, and none of them could really give me any great answers. So I started just stretching a lot through my hips and loosening up my lower back, and I sort of started doing a bit of calisthenic stuff. And sure enough, within a few months, I had my core back and I had my hips were looser, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, I haven't dragged my toe for like 2 months. Well, and occasionally I do it. Like, I will still do it. I did it one of my recent surfs that got caught again, and I can kind of look back and go, all right, if I'm not stretching, if I'm not doing those flexibility through my hips, my glutes, my lower back, getting that rotation happen, getting my core strong, my toe will drag again. So I think I learned that out of the injury, but I actually think it's just an age thing as well. I think as you get older, you tighten up, and if you're really not looking after yourself, it's going to become a real problem as you get older. So yeah, I guess one of the key things out of that injury was that I have to work even harder on that flexibility through the hips, glutes, hammies, get that rotation, core strong. And I think, unfortunately, as you get older, you just have to work super, super hard to keep that flexibility.
Wow. Yeah, that's super valuable advice. And sorry to hear you went through that. That sounds gnarly, getting your toe all swollen up and black and fracturing from just dragging it. That sounds awful. And not being able to surf for 8 months, that sounds awful. So I'm glad you're through it.
The worst thing was I did a minor tear on my right knee the November the year before, and I started surfing again in February. So I was out for pretty much 4 months there. And then in June, I snapped my MCL, like a clean 100% rupture of what they call it. So actually that year, so not last year, the year before, so 2022, I only surfed 4 months for the whole year.
Wow.
Wasn't fun.
Wow. Well, I mean, your new job is doing surfboard reviews, so you have no excuses. You got to be surfing all the time, right? So that's probably part of the calculus,
That's in the roster. I
right?
wrote my roster on a Sunday night, and then I can work around talking to the filmers, working at what gaps I've got in the roster from the shop and the surf school, and then I can make time to make time to get out in the water and do some filming and have a surf. So it is part,
Wow.
it's l legitimately part of my job now. It's been a surfboard review guy that it's on the roster.
That's perfect. All your plans, it's all coming together. Sweet. Well, one
Yeah.
last question for you. If you had to surf one wave for the rest of your life, what would it be like? You don't have to, you could describe waves, you could blend waves. What are the conditions? What are the size? What's it like? Right, left? What would be that wave that you have to surf for the rest of your life?
Oh, there's so many waves I haven't surfed yet. I don't know. As far as the rest of my life, whew,
I
I'd
know,
say
it's a hard
Nalu,
one.
but I'd end up that injured if I surfed that for the rest of my life. Yeah, Nalu's pretty damn good, but it's an intense wave and it's, super heavy. And I don't know. I think I'd have to go a right-hander. Can I take all the people out of there?
Yep, you
Am I
can
allowed
pick
to
any
empty the
wave.
lineup?
It's your dream wave, and it's like you are, God, and you're
Oh, here we
making this wave
go.
for yourself. Yeah.
It would be really hard to go past Snapper. Like every time I'm out at Snapper, I just go, imagine having this place to yourself on a 5 foot. Like Snapper, like when the super bank's really, really good, you can
Yeah.
get either a couple of really long tubes or you get 5 tubes on it. It's pretty hard to go past that, especially on my forehand because we don't get to go right all that often in West Oz. We're surrounded by left-handers. I'd probably say Snapper because you can get tubes, you can do turns. It's such a different changing wave, tide, swell directions, cyclones, the way the bank's lined up. Like you still get a massive variety of waves. So, yeah, I'd have
Oh
to
my
say
God.
Snapper for me.
Oh
And
my
you're in
God, that wave
boardies.
looks
It's
so
warm
good.
water.
Oh yeah. I was just watching this one clip of Mick Fanning on a wave there, and it's like he's like literally under sea level in this tube. Like you can see like his head just peeking up above the sand. I'm just like, that wave looks insane. But what is it like to actually surf the wave with 3,000 people on it? Is it just mayhem?
I was there last week. I don't surf it all that often. A lot of the time I'll go to the Gold Coast for work and I'll just go, nah, I can't do it. I'm not in the mindset of dealing with that. But because there's a lot of other waves there too, like I only surfed out there last week. I had sort of four or five surfs. I only had one at Snapper. The last one last week was pretty lucky. I managed to get like four or five behind the rock
Oh,
and
nice.
only got dropped in on once. So that was handy. So that was pretty good, but a lot of the times it's hit and miss. Sometimes I'll go out there and I'll get one wave in 3 hours that I'm happy with, and then other times I'll have a good run and get a dozen. But I think the bigger it gets, the bigger it gets, and the more wider ones they are, and the current's really strong, the more things you throw at it to make it harder. That's when you tend to find the really good ones. Like you'll be sort of paddling back out, and all of a sudden there's big wide one comes through and you get a roll in that runs all the way down past Green Mountain, because it's not just Snapper. Like that whole super bank, there's like five different waves on there, and you could travel like a K and a half. Just you might get one, paddle back out, turn around, get another one, go for another 300 meters, paddle back out, pick up another one, you go down into Cooley and down towards Kira, and some of the best waves I've ever had have actually been down that last stretch right down the end.
Oh
So
my God.
yeah, it's just a it is it can be your worst nightmare and it can be amazing. Like it when it's so crowded. Like I don't deal with crowds like that. It's ridiculous, but occasionally you just jag a nugget and it's unreal. But yeah, so
God, that
Snapper's
sounds
the one
good.
for me.
Okay, that makes sense. And maybe that crowd is what makes the wave so good. Not, obviously you'd prefer like an uncrowded version of it, but like when you have to contend with the crowd and you still score, that sounds like just extra payoff because it was so, hard to get what you wanted. But all right. That sounds epic. Well, thanks for joining. Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, no worries, man. Thanks for having me. Hopefully, there's something in there for the listeners and the viewers to to take out of that. But if not, oh well, sorry.
Nah, that was full of gold. All right. Cool.
Hey everyone, it's Van. Hopefully you've been enjoying the podcast. Hopefully you've been listening to some good stories, getting some good tips that are helping you improve as a surfer. If so, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review. It'll only take you literally a few seconds, and share it with your friends. That's the best way you can support me so I can continue to create awesome new content for you. So thanks.